I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:34 p.m. on Monday, February 3rd, 2020. Present today looks like we have a full House. Representative Knopp, Representative LeBon, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Johnston, Representative Sylvan Leonard, Representative Josephson, Representative Wool, Representative Merrick, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. Just a reminder, if folks could please mute their cell phones. And today we have the Department of Health and Social Services with us. The department will be presenting on two topics. First will be the budget overview for the whole department, and then we will move into a presentation of the Medicaid budget. We're hoping to spend an hour on the overall department side of the presentation and then spend the last hour on the Medicaid budget update. And so with that, if Commissioner Adam Crum could please come to the table, as well as Assistant Commissioner Sana Eford. I'm a little rusty here. We had you up here numerous times last year, and let's see here. I understand that there is just a single PowerPoint for both of the presentations, so members feel free to ask questions as we go along. And again, just to emphasize, the Medicaid update will be following the budget overview, so we may not want to get too far into Medicaid questions, because again, that will be the focus of the second part of their presentation. So with that, if both of you could put yourselves on the record, and welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Adam Crum, Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'm joined here today by Assistant Commissioner Sana Eford. Also in the room for the Medicaid portion, we'll bring up Director Renee Gayhart of the Division of Healthcare Services.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sana Eford. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Thank you for having us here today. So the first, or slide number two, depicts the Department of Health and Social Services total budget comparison of FY19, fiscal year 2019, to fiscal year 2021. And you can see from the comparison of two years that there is a small reduction of $41,879,000, which is 3.7% reduction in our budget across those 2 years. I'd like to point out a couple of things in this slide. If you look at the comparison of the bar graphs of our UGF, DGF, other, and federal funds, you can see that in FY21, the governor's proposed budget is 60.1% federal authority and 32% unrestricted general funds, with the balance of the other funding sources.
And I've got a question from Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just as we move through these presentations, when we do comparisons from FY19 to FY21, is it safe to say that we're actually talking about the actuals of FY19 versus the budget that passed in FY19?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we're comparing to the management plan, which is the budget that was passed in 19, with the adjustments that the department does to actually implement the budget. So it is the number that was enacted in the budget. But management plans, sometimes there are changes, minor changes in maybe a line item change.
So just, again, for the sake of the rest of the day, so does it reflect then any supplementals that were done to FY19, does it reflect actually the budget that was passed, the management plan that was passed, before there might have been a need for supplementals?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, the 19 does include the supplementals in these numbers, but I'm going to show, the next slides will show actually 20 to 21 comparisons.
Okay, thank you.
So the next slide shows the FY fiscal year 20 to fiscal year 21 operating budget comparison. Again, you can see the funding source breakout. From FY 20 to 21, there is an increase of $133,747,000, which is a 13.8% difference in the UGF. And the following slide four will show you the basic major changes from the governor's, the 20 budget to the governor's proposed budget. So on the next slide, you'll see all the increments. And these are basically unrestricted general fund changes, major changes in the 20 to the 21 budget. And I will be going over each of these as they apply to specific divisions in their slide. And I'll be happy to come back to this at some point, but it may, as we go through the divisions, I'll point out where this change is being requested. Again, to show what all of the Department of Health and Social Services funding sources are, here is a breakdown of those sources. Again, this is our FY21 ask for the governor's proposed budget. You can see our total budget. Excuse me, let me get the total budget being requested is $3,445,197,000. Those are all funding sources. This slide also breaks out the department's budget between formula-driven programs and non-formula programs. And if I can direct you to the top line is formula, the bottom line, non-formula. Under UGF, our formula programs make up approximately 75% of our UGF total, with the majority of that budget being Medicaid. 58% of our formula UGF is Medicaid funding. The other non-formula programs consist of 25%. A formula program, as you may recall, is a program that has an eligibility requirement attached to it before, and that eligibility must be met before a payment then is made out to a recipient.
Now, you said that the grand total is $3.4 billion, and I don't see that there, but I assume that is prior to the duplicate being removed?
Chair Foster, that is correct. That is just to show, again, I think you may have heard this in other presentations, OMB was trying to show that some funds are actually budgeted in other either departments in the state, or they may be budgeted internally through our own divisions. For instance, we have chargeback costs that are budgeted in our budget that you would see going as receipts to the Department of Administration to pay for OIT and those services. We also have those type of transfers within our own budget. So there are some funds that are accounted for in two places, and that's to show that duplicate. So as we get into the next slides, I wanted to show each division's FY20 to FY21 budget comparison slide and point out the differences. So for the Alaska Pioneer Homes component, their total FY21 governor's request is $501,700. And you can see the two major changes from 20 to 21. We are asking for an increment of $5 million in unrestricted general funds to be included in the Pioneer Homes payment assistance component. And we are also doing a technical cleanup or adjustment of funding sources to true up exactly what the Pioneer Homes will be, feel like they will be receiving in this current fiscal year, in 21 fiscal year.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need some clarification. So I see the $5 million add to the Pioneer Homes in UGF. How does the cleanup work that they end up getting a net cut of almost the same amount of $4.4 million.
In the other funding, so last year during the budget process for Pioneer Homes, we went to a different component budget structure. So in the past, they had one component that was budgeted as with all the Pioneer Homes in it, and then there was a smaller component which was for the administrative cost. Last year, OMB changed, and we actually inserted a new budget structure that accounted for payment assistance. And so all the money that was collected, that was coming into the Pioneer Homes budget as general funds, sits in a separate component. It's called the payment assistance component. It is actually only used as residents come into the home and they have their income eligibility portion that they meet. When they are approved for assistance, that payment assistance component is billed, per se, to meet the needs monthly for each of the residents that need help in making their payments and staying into the home. Last year, the other funds here, there was, again, some duplication of how that funding source should actually show up into the Pioneer Homes component. So this is really trying to clean up and make sure we have the exact payment assistance UGF number and that we're accounting for it correctly as it's billed and comes in as interagency receipts or other funds into the actual Pioneer Home component for each of the homes where that resident resides. So that piece is truly a technical shoring up those how those funding sources come in. This is a true $5 million general fund increase to meet the needs of residents in the homes.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair. So if I'm in charge of running the Pioneer Homes, and this year, by request, I'm going to get $98.5 million, and last year I got $102.8 million. Will I experience an increase in $5 million and say, wow, this year is better than last year? Or will I experience a decrease in $4.4 million and go, I'm going to have to figure out where to come up with some savings for $4.4 million? I mean, at the end of the day, according to this, the total is a decrease, although you did add $5 million. And I understand you're shoring up of accounts, sort of, and you're moving monies around in different accounts. But to the person running the whole operation there, are they going to experience the $5 million increase to deal with shortcomings, or are they going to experience a $4.4 million decrease?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, this is the projection the Pioneer Homes have given us to meet the needs of the residents that they're serving. Let me go back and also try this reduction in other funds. So the other funds component, what comes in the funding for this is actually payment, like I said, the payment assistance amount that comes in. If you notice here, we are also requesting a decrement in the DGF funds, and those funds are private pay that come in. So what we're trying to do for the Pioneer Homes, it's always based on a projection, not knowing how many residents in the home are actually going to need payment assistance, because unfortunately, I think throughout the year, I think an average of over 130, we lose about 130 of our Pioneer Home residents each year. So a new person coming into the home may not be in the same category. They may not be in a private pay category of the person that left the home. So we may need to provide them a payment assistance. This budget is trying to reflect exactly the best projection that we can make based on information that we have right now for the residents, and trying to make some prediction about who will come in and what their finances might look like.
Thank you. Last follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But it sounds like, based on what's happened in the last year, that you could project that you'll get more fees paid privately since the rates went up, and people that could pay it before maybe can pay a little more now without going into the assistance pool. But you would anticipate, based on what you told us last year, that the increase in rates would increase the amount that you would take in a DGF, not a decrease. Well, I'm sorry, other. That would be the other, not the DGF. Or maybe it is DGF.
Through the chair. Representative Wohl, I think where we're getting confused, and I will get back with you, is that the budget, the funding sources for the budget in 20 were not exactly accurate because we were trying to make this change. We added the payment assistance. We were showing it in the Pioneer Homes. And there was, I think we had double counted some things with making that technical change. I will be happy to get back with you, and I would be happy to sit with you and walk through it. But we feel like this budget will fully fund the needs of the residents coming into the homes that will need payment assistance.
Representative Ortiz.
First, I'd like to be a part of that explanation, sure, if that explanation happens. So just put my request in there. Along the same lines that Representative Wohl was asking his question, can we look at this $5 million as this request for a $5 million increase in payment assistance as a recalculation as to how much assistance would be needed after the increase in rates went into effect? And for example, how much of a change in population did we see, not as a result of people passing away, but as a result of people looking at these rate increases and deciding, no, this is not good for me anymore, and they left. So can you answer that question?
Mr. Commissioner?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, to Representative Ortiz. We believe that it was 16 people that left because of the rates, the change that to much better match our cost of care. Through this process as well, one of the items is we actually did have an increase of payments that came from the individuals of almost over $7 million. And that's one of those new aspects. The $5 million is going to actually help provide us the flexibility as individuals change out, because we do have about 130 individuals on year that we average as turning over within the Pioneer Homes. And so that's one of those, not knowing which of those individuals are going to be able to pay on their own or to have payment assistance, this actually would allow us to have that buffer, and it is only for payment assistance. This does not go towards administrative costs or any other items. This is essentially a pool to make sure that being able to pay is not a precursor for individuals coming into the home.
So I guess as a follow-up, sorry, thank you. I know that we, last year when we were talking about the proposed pay increase or fee increase, there was at least one presenter that made the projection that while the impact of the proposed rate increase might appear on paper that it would in fact save the state a lot of UGF money, but in reality it would cause a shift of the population so that we would see a higher percentage of the population that are currently occupying Pioneer Homes being unable to have the resources to pay on their own, and thereby the projection would be that we actually might see a near equal obligation on the part of the state to make up for this change in population where we have people coming in who don't have the ability to pay those rate increases, and then the state would then be obligated almost as much as they were before. You see what I'm saying? Is that, can we make that determination at this point, or are we still waiting for some more information on that?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, at this point, we've actually increased the amount of dollars coming in the door. And so we plan it out into the future. The Pioneer Home has a unique aspect in the way it sits in Alaska. The average age of the resident coming in is 87 years old. And so these are individuals who come in, and it's a comforting community-like environment, and it is a very high, you know, very high turnover situation. And so this is one of those to where, from the best of our knowledge over this last couple of months, using this rate increase to match our cost of care, that we anticipate that we're actually having a little bit of a state savings decrease.
A state savings decrease?
It were increased state savings.
Do we know how much? Go ahead.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I think the Pioneer Homes is still down about $2 million, a little over $2 million in their UGF, but that's what I would be happy to sit down and walk you through where we were in 19, where we ended in 20, and what we're asking for in 21. This just shows you the 20 to 21, but we can go back and I'll be happy to do that.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to belabor this further, but Commissioner, you said there was additional fees coming into the system, and would those not be they'd be reflected in one of the four rows, would they not? So which one should I look to see the additional fees?
Through the chair, again, as I was trying to, I'm not doing a very good job, I don't think, of saying there was a technical error in the way the budget was built in 20, and so we're trying to correct for that. But the additional fees that would be coming in with private pay would be the designated general fund, the DGF. And yes, you do see a reduction there, but again, there's a cleanup happening between 19 to 20 and 20 to 21.
Please continue.
The next slide depicts the budget for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And this budget, in comparison from FY 20 to 21, the total request is $55,376,600. The change to this budget is an increment to achieve full capacity of 80 beds at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and that is spread with $2,529,200 of unrestricted general funds and the balance in other funds. The increase in the other funds will be to start billing and receiving payment through Medicaid for the 1115 services. We're not sure exactly when the mental health services will begin, but this is in anticipation of receiving those funds.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess two questions, were you not getting Medicaid payments prior to this 1115? I mean, are residents at API eligible for Medicaid?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes, they are. We are already receiving Medicaid. This will be additional new services under the 1115 waiver that will now be covered under Medicaid.
And follow up. Expanding to 80 beds, these other funds are being used, or the 2.6, I guess, is to use for the expansion, and the $6.4 million is for anticipated 1115 monies coming in. I guess if that doesn't come in, you're still going to expand to 80 people, correct? You still have the resources to do that.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, this is to, again, as I was saying, the increment itself is to try and provide the resources to meet the staffing requirements that we will need to open the 80 beds. This just reflects how we feel like we're going to be able to capture the funding to do that, and we have the opportunity to increase our federal claiming through, it comes through the Medicaid budget. It's federal, it's a split of federal, depending on who the recipient is. But this is a way, again, to show in the budget how we anticipate the revenues will come in to support that increase in capacity.
Thank you.
The next division is our Division of Behavioral Health. Changes for this division in their budget from FY20 to FY21, you can see the largest change is an $11.4 million fund source switch that is moving from unrestricted general funds that now is being funded through the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund, which shows up in the DGF column. There was also a reduction in DGF because there was a two-year appropriation that ended this year of ACHI funds, which are the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Funds, which are DGF funds too. So you're seeing the net of changes when you look at this column. And again, it's not exact numbers because there are salary adjustments and changes that happen and other minor technical adjustments I'm trying to outline for you each time there's a major change in their budget.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you through the chair. As you know, we had questions in subcommittee as far as the sustainability of the $11.7 million and still have questions about that and would still be interested in finding out what you feel is really sustainable year over year from the marijuana fund and what maybe would be more one time. Thank you.
Through the chair, co-chair Johnston, we will continue to look at that and analyze it. I think as I stated, OMB feels like this is sustainable for the next few years, but we will have to do a close look at that fund to ensure that we do have the dollars coming into that that would sustain this appropriation.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Just to be clear, when there was a reduction in the behavioral health portion of the overall budget, providers still could file their claims through the agency. And notwithstanding the completion of the 1115 waiver, those will show up in the supplemental. Is that basically accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not sure I exactly understand your question. In there was in FY20 a $12 million UGF reduction to the behavioral health grants. That was in anticipation of those grantees being able to bill under Medicaid for, again, the 1115 substance misuse, substance SUD, I'll get the wrong term, substance misuse disorder, abuse disorder services. That is happening. They are making that transition and switch. I think you may have had another part of your question there, though.
A follow-up. So everything you said is familiar to me, but I guess what I'm saying is unless people got substantially better, quote-unquote, the need will be comparable to FY19. We underfunded it by $12 million in anticipation of the grants approval, the waiver approval. That hasn't been done. So how is that? How are those bills being paid?
The waiver approval, I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Josephson, the waiver approval for the services of the SUD services has been approved.
Right, but
those are showing up in the Medicaid budget now,
right,
and are being billed there for these grantees that are transitioning to be Medicaid providers.
Follow up. I'm aware of that part too, but what about the behavioral health part? Isn't half of this waiver program is pending? Correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. But I believe, and I might need a lifeline for the program piece because I'm not the program person for the 1115. But I believe the SUD services that were under these grantees are being covered. They are part of that. The additional piece we're waiting on is for services of the IMD exclusion, the over 16 beds, and that would be through that has not been fully approved and implemented. That would be the API portion that we can charge for when that's approved.
I think we've got might be somebody online also.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Albert Wall. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. of Health and Social Services. There's two of us here that can perhaps answer two portions to that question. One is Jen Moreau, who's the Director of Behavioral Health, and she is on the line, I believe. She can speak directly to the SUD portion in the 1115 rollout, and if there's a specific question going back to the API expenditure shift, I would be glad to take that one. So not to put Jen on the spot, but the services that are being provided under the 1115 for the substance use disorder services are already online. They're being rolled out a little bit at a time, so it's not 100% up front. What may be a little bit confusing is that the old way of billing under Medicaid is still there. So some services are still being billed under clinic services and rehab. Well, some of our providers are moving forward and have enrolled in the 1115 are able to bill under that. So there's basically two different forms to bill underneath behavioral health SUD right now. The reduction in grants was in anticipation of the first portion or the SUD phase, and then the second portion will be anticipated next fiscal year.
And Ms. Moreau Johnson, are you there? If you are, if you could put yourself on the record.
Hi there, thank you. This is Jennifer Moreau Johnson, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. I just want to check in and make sure folks can hear me.
We can hear you great, and if you heard the question, okay, go ahead and fire away.
Great, thank you. For the record, I'm through the chair. For the record, this is Jennifer Moreau through the chair. Let me see if I can walk through the sequence of milestones and see if that helps clarify. So I'm going back in time to 2016 at the point that SB 74 passed. That's when the grant decrements started being applied. So the decrements kind of got out of the gate ahead of the approval of the Section 1115 waiver demonstration project. At the end of November of 2018, we received approval from the federal government for the substance use disorder component. So that added about 12 new services to be covered by Medicaid for substance use disorder treatment. As Deputy Commissioner Wall mentioned, this is in addition to what we can call regular Medicaid, what's covered by the Medicaid state plan. So in addition to the Medicaid state plan, there are new services coming online. And as we phase in these new services, in order to become compliant with federal regulation, we'll phase out some of the services from the state plan, although some will remain. We started seeing, because of the implementation process, it took a while, and we started seeing claims come in around about October of 2019. And looking at those claims, what we're seeing, now we have just a few claims to look at, but the claims that we can see, what we're seeing is that agencies are being kept whole, and in fact, the snapshot that we have so far is the revenue from Medicaid coverage is actually a little bit higher than what the grant funding was. And then the good news is that while the grant funding was entirely GF, we are now, because most of this population based on the claims data that we looked at is expansion, we are now reducing the GF to around about 10%. So we're on track to do what we hope to accomplish with substance use disorder. The behavioral health component has received approval from the federal government. We have regulations in draft form, and we are hoping to get those regulations on the street and get those services paid by Medicaid as soon as possible, no later than June, but we'd like to get that revenue on the streets faster than that if we can. So we're working on that. And then the last piece, as mentioned, is the IMD, which is the Institute for Mental Disease Exclusion, getting an exemption for the mental health part of the IMD exclusion to allow Medicaid coverage for individuals over 21 and under 64 in facilities of 16 beds or more for mental health services. So that was a lot of information, but I hope that helped track the milestones for the decrements and then the onboarding of the 1115 revenue.
Very good. Thank you.
And Mr. Wall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more point of clarity I'd like to make is one of the reasons why the 1115 was divided into those two portions for substance abuse and SMI is because the substance abuse service providers that are billing underneath the 1115, even around the topic of the Institutes of Mental Disease, bill as 1115 providers. The providers like API that bill serious mental illness in residence as a hospital inpatient, bill as a hospital inpatient, not technically as a behavioral health provider under the 1115. The ability for them to do that comes through that waiver but they still bill as a hospital. Why this is important is to go back to the question that was asked previous about the fund shift that occurred in API's numbers for this coming year. Yes, while individual adults that were in API may have been eligible for Medicaid while they were there, they're unable to bill because of the IMD issue. So when the IMD exemption occurs, they will be able to bill under Medicaid, even though they're inpatient in an SMI facility. I know that's a nuance, but the shift is that they may have been eligible for it, but were unable to bill Medicaid while they were at API previous.
Representative Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this warrants a separate discussion, but so when you're going back to API, there was an increase in other funds because you're able to bill 1115 waiver. But if I'm a resident patient there, am I getting sort of double billed for being there and then billed for getting substance abuse services as well? Is that, and then you're getting refunded at both?
Representative Wolf, through the chair, API is only doing the inpatient psychiatric piece. They're not doing the substance abuse piece.
Well, you mentioned 1115 waiver, and that was on the other. There was an increase in the other.
Yes, I see what you're saying, Representative Wolf, through the chair. So the clarification point that I was trying to make was there is a shift in Medicaid expenditure in API in the coming years because of the IMD exemption. The difference between the substance abuse providers and the serious mental illness providers is the substance abuse providers are actually billing as 1115 providers. Well, the ability to bill Medicaid for an inpatient hospital psychiatric is made available through the 1115 waiver. They are, in fact, not 1115 providers. They bill under hospital services. So they bill under two types of services, but both because of the 1115.
Commissioner Crum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For clarification's sake, because Medicaid is exceptionally technical, I believe what Representative Wohl is asking, at some point during this coming fiscal year, we highly anticipate getting the IMB exclusion to bill against the behavioral health portion, which would allow us to see this increase in revenue for the incoming dollars. And hope that helps, sir.
Yes, and follow up. And with that increase in revenue, you could expand the number of beds, or without it, you can't. Is that, am I hearing that correctly? Or are you expanding the number of beds regardless?
Representative Wolf, through the chair. The constraint on number of beds has more to do with staffing than it does to do with revenue. So if we are able to hire more staff, we can open more beds. That's not tied directly to the revenue line. The staffing's already budgeted.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Any further questions on this? I don't see any. Please continue.
So our next division within Health and Social Services is the Office of Children's Services. Their budget request for FY21 is $172,605,600. The two major changes within their budget are for the request for federal authority. One is for a $1,500,000 increment to use Family First Prevention funds to help retain and to provide initiatives for staffing to help recruit and retain our OCS frontline workers. The other federal increment that we're requesting is Title IV-E reimbursement. That is a new opportunity for the state to collect federal revenue to offset expenditures for legal services for parents that are in court with a child in need of aid. So we're asking for additional federal authority of $1,200,000. We're still, this will be in coordination with the Public Defender Office and the Office of Public Advocacy to work with them to help either offset some of their costs or help them be able to realign their general funds to use in a different way. So this is, we're in coordination with those offices.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. you know, this particular area of health and social services is where I hear the most feedback from my constituents in my particular district. And what I consistently hear is not being able to receive adequate services for the basic mission of protecting our children across the state, high caseloads, things like that. Does this particular budget that you're requesting for FY21 do anything to better meet the demand of services from residents across the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, thank you for that question, sir. Yes, it does, because one of the aspects that we are looking at is responding to the community in different ways. Through the 1115 waiver, there's a lot of different mechanisms in there that are approved under the behavioral health side, one of them being peer supports. So this is a different billing mechanism that could be capable to set up community groups that actually can work with parents to help them navigate this very difficult process through the child welfare system. Another aspect we have going on, as you mentioned, the community resource side, is hopefully in the next month or two, we'll have released the gap analysis study that was paid for by the Mental Health Trust, to where it was initially for the 1115 study for behavioral health services, but we were able to coincide along with Office of Children's Services to tour around the state to actually identify what community resources are available for both behavioral health and OCS. And so we can actually work then to help refer out and do as much as possible with these community groups, because it's one of those aspects as social determinants of health becomes much more predominant, is that you have to have the community supports for the protective factors to keep families together and resilient. And one of the aspects under the federal Family First Prevention Act has allowing us as a state to really focus on that. We did just have, it's either a 2 or 5 year approval, I'm not quite sure, it's the program improvement plan for OCS was just submitted this last year and approved by the federal government. So we're excited about that. A lot of that has to deal with our preventative measures that we're gonna be working on. And so it's, while this budget reflects directly for OCS services, we are making sure that we are tying into other mechanisms to pay for this throughout, either in the community or through the 1115 waiver as well.
Thank you.
Please continue.
The next division within Health and Social Services is our Healthcare Services Division. This budget is basically showing a flat budget. The 21 request is $20,149,000. The decrements that you see are actually not reductions. They are actually transfers that you will see show up in the commissioner's office under Departmental Support Services. The Office of Rate Review has been under the structure of healthcare services, but that office actually determines rates for all of the Medicaid program, and so we felt it much more appropriate to be within the commissioner's office instead of just in healthcare services, since it also works with behavioral health rates and senior disabilities rates. The next division is the Division of Juvenile Justice. Again, basically, their budget is depicting a flat budget, and their budget for FY21, $59,255,700.
Now, there was the cut of the Nome Youth Facility, and that was, I believe, a $2 million cut. But rather than seeing a reduction here in juvenile justice, we're seeing an increase. Can you explain that?
Chair Foster, that reduction happened from 19 to 20. So that was the reduction of the Nome Youth Facility reduction was in 20. So when that was a $2 million reduction there. So now you're seeing just after the cut in 20 to the 21 budget. And basically the major adjustments here are salary increases and those other technical adjustments to the budget. So the $2 million is actually from 19 to 20.
There were some costs that were affiliated with that cut. For example, sending the kids from the travel not just to other facilities, but I believe also going back and forth because there may be court appearances and so forth. That's all built into this budget. Can you explain? I mean, that's part of the cost. What other costs? You've got costs of like the chaperones and so forth. I don't know if you can explain some of the other costs that were affiliated. I guess my concern was the cut was made in an effort to save some money, but there are also offsetting increments as well.
Through the chair, or sorry, Mr. Chair, I apologize. We have maintained staff in Nome for probation services, as well as a different facility in order to hold some of the kids until they can be transferred out. A lot of the items that have moved forward are items like Zoom, which is a meeting capacity to allow kids to actually interface back with their parents, as well as interact a lot with the judges as opposed to flying back and forth. And so we've actually had a good partnership with the court system that way to keep some of these costs down. And we're currently working on a lot of different partner groups based in Nome to talk about the best use of that facility as a public use aspect. And so there's been a lot of ideas and ongoing conversations on that. So we think we're going to make a lot of progress there as to how can that facility then be used for the public going forward.
Are you keeping track of the actual savings? I know that there are proposed savings, and I don't know if the savings are actually being realized, and I'd just be interested in, as we go forward, to see how on target we are with those. If you could maybe let us know, I guess, periodically.
Yeah. Chair Foster, we will be happy to provide that.
Thank you. No questions, please continue.
The next division is the Division of Public Assistance. The governor's request for this budget is $297,027,700. The difference in this budget is basically a restoration of the adult public assistance maintenance of effort methodology. If you remember, we had originally proposed to revert to a 1983 methodology for computing our maintenance of effort amount, and after looking at some of those reductions, the governor has decided to reinstate this program. So we are asking for the $7,764,300 back. Actually, I'm sorry, associated to that is $7,471,000 of UGF. And I have, this is incorrect, and I apologize. We've looked at these slides a zillion times, and this other transfer actually should be on the public health slide. So really the main difference for the public assistance is reinstating the current total expenditure methodology for the public assistance payments for the maintenance of effort number.
Representative Knopf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll apologize up front for not being more familiar with some of these programs because this is a budget I never look at. So in not 30 words or less, but a brief synopsis, please, of the adult public assistance maintenance efforts, exactly what that program is. And then second question, can you just highlight, I'm going to say eligibility requirements for some of the public assistance programs for others, please? And just quickly synopsis, I'm just trying to get a feel for where it's at.
Through the chair, Representative Knopf, I will try to talk about the budget side about it, then I'll let the commissioner talk about the eligibility piece. But the Adult Public Assistance Program is a program that the state is required to have as our maintenance of effort, our match for our Medicaid program. These are payments that go out to age blind and disabled. And there are a number of eligibility calculations, income calculations related to who receives these payments. There is also, we have to spend a specific amount of money called a maintenance of effort on this program as the match for the Medicaid program. There are two ways the state can calculate what their total maintenance of effort or their piece of the state funding that has to go to this program. One is reverting to what the payments were in 1983 with cost of living increases, which is what was proposed in our original 20 budget. And the other calculation was to maintain current total expenditures of how we were making these payments over the last, I don't have the exact number of years, but what we currently spend on this. We had estimated that the department or the state could save some funding in this fiscal year of a little over $7 million if we reverted to the 1983 calculation. However, when we looked at those, determined that we thought those reductions were just more than the governor would like to put forward. So we're reinstating to the current maintenance, which is an increase in the amount of money that the state will spend in match for this program to the Medicaid. Okay. Does that help?
It does help. Thank you.
And through the chair, Representative Knopp. As far as the other aspects, the Division of Public Assistance administers the eligibility and the intake for all different programs, for federal, from the temporary assistance to needy families and supplemental nutrition to state programs like senior benefits. And so the eligibility varies across the board. And so we have our eligibility techs have to work at that and look at every case individually because it is across a spectrum and over the length of time that an individual remains eligible for a certain program.
Fair enough. Thank you.
Further questions? Seeing none.
So I'm going to, like I said, take this other bullet, transfer parents as teachers, which should be on this Division of Public Health slide. So again, I apologize for that error. The next Division of Public Health, their FY21 governor's request, $118,749,700. You can see their major increase is in other funding, which is actually an increase from SB 93 that authorized them to collect statutory designated program receipts from employers that will be employing the SHARP 3 applicants for the health care providers coming into the state that we're trying to attract into the state. The other increase here, as I said, is a transfer from the Department of Education for Parents as Teachers program into our Women, Children, and Family Health component in public health.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you talk a little bit more about the that particular transfer as it relates to the overall goal of the governor to increase services, not increase services, but increase opportunity for preschool learning opportunities, those kinds of things. In other words, what's the motivation for this particular change, and does it fit within the overall goals of the governor in terms of increasing reading levels and things like that? Does that make sense?
Do you want me to take that, or you take that?
Sorry, I had to recalibrate there. Madam, through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So this program has historically been appropriated to the Department of Education Early Development, but they have RSA'd the funds over to the Department of Health and Social Services. Is that RSA?
Reimbursable Service.
Reimbursable Service Agreement, I apologize. I've gotten acronymed up. And which means that we have actually been providing the services through our Women, Children, Family Health Program within public health for the last couple of years. And so a cleaner way of doing this was just to actually put this program in the Department of Health and Social Services directly. As far as some of the other items, this is one of the only very few evidence-based programs that actually meets the needs for Office of Children's Services to access dollars through the Family First Prevention Act as well. And so this is a program alignment aspect where this is within the department and actually meets the goals of a couple different agencies.
Okay, thanks. I'll have more questions probably at the subcommittee level, but thank you.
The next division, Senior and Disability Services, the governor's FY21 request of $69,569,300. Basically, I have to sit here and say I'm a little sad. We had asked for an increase, an increment of $7 million of federal funds for the preschool development grant. It was phase two of the grant that was going to be awarded. Senior and Disability Services put in the application for this portion of the grant. The next, if you remember, you may remember, Representative Ortiz, I know you were probably aware that education had received phase one of this grant, and it was to do an assessment. We were going to do the second phase of this through Seniors and Disabilities through the Infant Learning Program and working with the programs through the Alaska Education Coordinating Care, I'll say the wrong, three C's. But we were denied, we were not awarded this grant. So we are going to, you will see an amendment come that will actually adjust the $7 million request from their budget. Even though I will say it was amazing that they were able to get this grant submitted and they got really high marks, there were just more states applied than they had funds to give out, even though we received high marks. So I want to say kudos to SDS for getting that together and getting high marks. The other piece of the increase in their budget is the maintenance and operation funds for the electronic visit verification system, the maintenance and operations that they will need in their budget to run this system. It's 412.5 federal and 137,500 for unrestricted general funds, which is a 75-25 match for systems implementation or for running systems. And we received the capital funding for this system last year, and so we'll be implementing this in 21.
Representative Ortiz.
So going back to the topic of the $7 million grant that we will not be receiving, am I correct in understanding after your explanation that this was a grant, albeit to a different department, that was in existence and no longer will be in existence? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, this grant originated a year ago. It was a new grant by the federal government to address preschool development in states. States were asked to apply. State of Alaska applied through the Department of Education. We received that portion of the grant.
Stop right there. What happened with that portion of the grant then? Were there more opportunities for preschool as a result of being?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. So this grant was actually looked at and identified by the Alaska Early Childhood Coordinating Council, which of which I co-chair with Commissioner Johnson of Education. And so with this grant, the initial phase was for strategy around the state and actually did a very good job working with stakeholders. So there's all different groups from Head Start to Rural CAP to the A2P2, the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, South Central Foundation, tribal partners across the board sit on this council, and we really looked at and targeted where do we need to grow and actually build up child care programs within the state. And so we had a very good plan coming forward. Phase two was going to help us actually implement a lot of that plan, and that was the grant dollars that we did not receive.
And only the states that received that first assessment part were asked to apply for the second part. But like I said, we did not receive that piece. But the first part of the grant was completed.
Follow up?
No, it's okay. Thank you.
The next division, Departmental Support Services. The changes in this budget or our request is $46,258,600. The major changes in here are to add four positions to the commissioner's office for reorganization. And we are also, again, you're seeing the transfer of 16 positions into the commissioner's office for rate review that we just transferred from the healthcare services division into the commissioner's office.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, with that got sidetracked on the grant that we didn't receive. So could you go back to slide 14, please? Is it within this department that we also have DAHAB services being provided within senior disability services?
Through the chair, yes, sir.
And so where would, like, what would it just be? I guess what I'm saying is, how are we doing in that particular area? Because, again, I hear quite a bit of concern about the adjustments that have been made to that particular program over the last several years, and particularly in rural communities where they don't have alternatives to DAHAB services. They can't go to community centers and things like that. I've heard quite a bit of concern about this particular area. So what can you tell me about that?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. Sorry, I was clarifying as to how much was paid through SDS and the rest of that which was paid through Medicaid services. So for that program, there is a lot of community discussion on items like that. I do believe a portion of that is paid through grant programs from SDS, and we get a lot of public comment on that all the time and how is the best way to put forward services for that. It is an ongoing issue. We are in constant communication with a lot of our senior groups, our Governor's Council on Disability, Key Coalition, and these other groups trying to kind of move forward and what are the best services available. I do know that we are going through a regulation rewrite on the definitions on some of those, but defining much more a social model of help for the disabled population. And so it has been through a lot of input from those groups that we're trying to work on how these definitions and how much the level of service can they actually achieve and or what are the goals of the service. And so it's just a constant conversation. If you have particular items on that, I'd appreciate to talk you offline on.
Follow up? And is it safe to say, and I appreciate that effort and that constant conversation, but is it safe to say that over the last several years there's been a significant overall, whether it comes from whatever source, the net impact is there's been a significant reduction in services to DAHAB to that particular category?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I apologize. So I only know about from FY 21 to 21 and kind of the issues going forward, but I would be glad to follow up with you on that.
I appreciate that very much. Again, because I do hear about that particular concern from my constituents, and so it's an area that I would like further to be addressed. Thank you.
So the last, it's not necessarily a division, but the last budgeted component or appropriation is, of course, the Medicaid services appropriation. Within this appropriation are all the Medicaid service, the claims that come through under Medicaid, the behavioral health, the healthcare services, claims for inpatient, and the senior disability services Medicaid-covered claims. As you can see, the large change in this budget is we are asking for an increment of $143,400,000 in federal authority and $120 million in unrestricted general funds. We are also asking to restore the adult preventative dental program with $18,730,900 federal authority and $8,273,600 unrestricted general funds.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So last March and April, really March, when this committee was looking at this intensively, Ms. Eifert, I became knowledgeable enough to be dangerous. And I think I'm still sort of in that range. But let me take us back to, I think it was March, there was a hearing with Mr. Thiel that seemed sort of dramatic to me in that he declared that the governor, because of his authority under existing law, principally I think Title 47, and as governor, could put forward any state plan amendment that he wished, and with the cooperation of CMS make adjustments. And I guess my question is, where is the administration on those efforts now? Because the reform efforts that were being considered outside, I thought, of SB 74 were broader than adult preventative dental. They seemed more inclusive. Can you give me a sort of a sense of where the administration is on that?
Commissioner Crum. Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Over the next couple slides, Director Gayhart will join me, and we'll actually go through a lot of the cost containment measures we put forward in phase one, where they stand, to answer a lot of those questions.
Representative Johnson.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was going through my paperwork here, and we kind of skipped over the departmental support services because we went back and forth. And I now see the org charts, but could you just go through, I mean, we're going to have a deeper dive in this in the subcommittee, but you will be adding four positions to the commissioner's office for reorganization, and I just feel that just a little bit more time on it would be worthy.
Through the chair, Representative Johnson. One of the things that we're proposing with those four positions is to create a new deputy commissioner position along with some policy advisors underneath them so we can actually take the Office of Children's Services, Division of Juvenile Justice, and Adult Protective Services and align them into a Family and Protective Services essentially line. Through that, it allows increased focus and oversight over these kind of critical services for both family and children. Office of Children's Services is always a very emotionally charged issue because of the services that they provide. And it honestly, this is something that over time, they have not gotten the attention that they need. This has been something that 6 months ago, we actually sat down and I sent information out to all of my directors. And I asked them, I said, what is your ideal alignment within the department? One of the things that came up from more than a handful of directors was that they asked to not be associated with Medicaid anymore. Because with Medicaid in the discussion, they don't get talked to, and they don't get the attention that they feel they need to in order to fully support that. So this was something that really kind of struck home to me moving forward, and this was something we brought forward to the governor because he's child welfare outcomes has been something we've been a constant discussion on. How do we improve this? Because Alaska has historically had very low marks. And this was what we decided. One of the best ways for us to move forward is to actually create a new deputy commissioner position to oversee this Family Protective Services side. The current deputy commissioner would then see the Pioneer Home and Alaska Psychiatric Institute, and then you'd have your Medicaid deputy commissioner. And so we'd have that alignment there over this large organization of 3,700 employees to give them the focus and the attention that they need to so they don't get drawn into the Medicaid conversation. And this is one of the ideas we're putting forward. One of the policy positions also we are specifically putting forward is to have an ICWA or Indian Child Welfare Act or tribal liaison role. Because moving forward this state, if we don't have increased engagement with our tribal partners to provide services locally, we're not going to move the needle at all. So this is something that we realize is a very important position going forward for the future of Alaska.
Follow up.
So you're adding a deputy commissioner position and actually name the four different positions that you will be adding.
Chair Johnston, the positions are a deputy commissioner, a special assistant, and there are two project coordinators.
And that will be in addition to what we have currently in the department.
Through the chair, Chair Johnston, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions, Representative Wool?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to do the numbers here, those four positions would require those two tranches of funding, the $253,000 and $379,000, to about $630,000 for the four positions.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
And this is based on, the funding is based on our public assistance cost allocation plan where we can cost out the federal portion.
Please continue.
C, So I believe I'm going to turn the microphone over to Commissioner and Director Gayhart if there are no more questions for me.
And Renee Gayhartz, if you could put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Renee Gayhart. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services.
So, through Mr. Chair, through in front of you, we actually have a handout talking about the phase one rate reductions, as we called it initially when we put it forward. So we'll go over each one of these items, as well as some of the other snapshots involved. One thing I'd like to point is the numbers that we present on this are just the UGF dollars involved. We didn't actually put the federal dollars on there for conversation's sake. That one, and for this. So we did put forward a 5% provider rate reduction for Medicaid services. We did anticipate a over $21 million savings on this. So a number of things happened. We put forward this rate reduction with emergency regulations, and we had a disagreement with some of our partners over this. So we had to have a settlement to where we actually agreed to pay back the difference between the full amount and the 5% rate reduction between July 1 and September. And so we paid that dollars back. And then moving forward, then the rate reductions have been in place from Q2 of fiscal year 20 moving forward. So this is something that is going to have a major difference in what our projected savings are, because we're only going to have anticipated savings of $7 million because of that. It should be noted that along with that, and also what we put forward in the withholding Medicaid rate inflation on the next slide, which was anticipated savings of $11 million, we did hold a party harmless, and this was the home and community-based waiver services group. This is your disability, your aged and disabled population who are able to provide services in home and in community as opposed to eventually working to an institution. This was an item that we were moving through our normal rate process, and the governor asked us to actually really maintain a close eye on the access. And as we put forward, we realized that these rate reductions would negatively affect these abilities, these individuals to have access to care because of a lack of care coordinators within the state. This is a conflict-free interest aspect, and so that would very much limit the services that could be provided, and we decided to pull back on that. So that group was held harmless throughout it. Yeah, if you do have questions, I can slow down, but I was being mindful of the time.
Yes. Representative Josephson and then Sullivan Leonard.
Through the chair, Commissioner, are you saying then that in these first two categories, the FY21 budget restores the cuts from FY20? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Joseph, yes, a portion of the cuts that we look forward to, that we'd initially anticipated that we were going to save and we're not going to be able to achieve. And then looking forward in FY21, what are the increments we need to cover that gap?
Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner Crum, I apologize. Could we please go back to this slide? Page 16, if we could, please. So in looking at the UGF here, whoops, sorry about that. In looking at the UGF, for the component for the governor's request and also the management plan, do you have the supplemental budget included in this? And then also, can you explain then the increase of $127 million for the difference between 20 and 21?
So through the chair, Representative Sullivan Leonard, so the likely supplemental ballot would be in the $120 million range, and I believe that's being read on the floor tomorrow, if I'm not mistaken.
I understand the supplemental is supposed to be out today. We'll be taking it up on Wednesday in finance. In terms of it being on the floor, I don't believe. We'll have to find out about that.
I apologize, sir. And so for that amount, yes, there's the difference going forward. What we did talk with the governor was we did shock the system last year about where we're at and started the conversation, but then we asked for an increment in FY21 to bring stability to the system for providers so we don't have this large supplemental hanging out there so they anticipate running out of funds in the first or second quarter of this year, calendar year. And so this is one of those items moving forward that we asked, and the governor was supportive of, to move forward with this larger increment, so the Medicaid program have stability. We've encouraged all providers now to then approach us because of the ongoing fiscal situation in the state. What are the other items and creative aspects that we can do to work together to actually then continue to make efficiencies in the budget? And by efficiencies, that just simply means the dollars spent are being better used for better outcomes for patients.
Sure. And then follow up, please, Mr. Follow Chairman. Up. And just so I have it clear in my head here, so we're looking at the $127 million roughly for the governor's increase, but in addition to that, we will have a supplemental of $120.
Ms. Eford.
Is that what I'm hearing you say?
For the record, this is Santa Eford, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. Representative Sullivan Leonard, in at the FY20 numbers that you see there do not have a supplemental added into them. So there will be a supplemental request coming for the Medicaid budget.
Just for clarification, or as I understand it, so once the supplemental comes out, and it should be very close to, for this portion, not for everything else that will be in the supplemental, but just for this, it will be, should be about $128 million, and that supplemental will then be added to the, it'll change the adjusted base, and so that means that the difference should be pretty much an offset then, and it'll show a zero increase essentially because you've gone to the prior year and we've added, if we add $128 million to the prior year, then the difference between the prior year and the current year is going to be essentially about zero, correct?
Chair Foster, that is correct. That's why I'm saying since the bill has not been read on the floor introduced, we do not have the 20 supplementals in the column for the FY20 management plan numbers.
Thank you. Any further questions? Yeah. Representative Johnston.
Yes, actually through the chair, and I can see where the confusion is because there was a promise last year that there wouldn't be a supplemental on this or a cost increase, so I understand the issue. What my question is, since we're talking about providers and the rate adjustment, do we know when we will run out of funds to pay that? Because that's going to make a big difference in the supplemental. Do we have a date?
Chair Johnston, we are calculating that now, and we will be able to provide that information to the committee. We want to make sure we're doing everything to actually really tie down specifically when we feel like we will need the additional funds.
And just in follow-up, it concerns all of us because of they are going to have to pay for something that was done last year, and some are small businesses, and we're impacting their bottom line with the cash, you know, that they need. We've already incurred they've incurred the cost, and so I hope to get that as soon as possible.
And please proceed.
I apologize. We skip back ahead to, so slide 19 was the rate reduction to slide 20, the withholding. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that we did have a goal of really shooting for the moon last year, of trying to trim down our Medicaid budget. And through that, we put forward a lot of various ideas. Some of these items we were able to achieve. Some of them we were able to achieve partially. Some will be delayed a year, and some will not be achieved at all. And as we go through this list, we'll identify what those items are. So we've talked about on slide 19 and 20, the 5% of rate reduction, as well as the withholding of inflation. The next aspect is hospital-related, hospital diagnostic-related groups, or what's referred to as DRGs. This is essentially bundled payments, and this is the first step in moving towards a value-based payment system instead of the fee-for-service that Alaska currently uses. The anticipated savings from this were delayed because it's a very highly technical and highly complex aspect to put in. And so we have actually procured a contractor in Myers and Stauffer, they're an accounting and consulting firm, to work directly with the department as well as stakeholder groups to determine how to make this methodology effective in Alaska. And so it's an identifying process. We do anticipate this change of payment methodology by January 1st of 2021 fully implemented. Next aspect is the long-term care rate reduction. This is your skilled nursing facilities and assisted living homes. We had initially put forward a 5% rate reduction on this group, and then in talking with this group, because of the fragile nature and aspect of these situations and how they operate, we really looked at what can we do to help, and then we were able to adjust it, but we could only go to a 3% rate reduction because of an item called the UPL, the upper payment limit, which is the amount of dollars that the federal authority we have to bill against this level of service. And so we still had to do a 3% rate reduction to maintain under our upper payment limit cap. We did anticipate $2 million savings, and we're on track to achieve that this year. Another item that we were able to achieve was the cost of end-stage renal disease, or ESRD, put forward a $1 million savings, and we will achieve that this year. This is one of the long-term programs. So this is actually a change in the program going forward. So the rate reduction and the withhold inflation are items that we would have to do each year. This is an item, though, that will actually change the basis of the program for moving into the future. So this was, we refined payments to these clinics based upon actual costs as opposed to flat rates.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So actual costs versus flat rates, what does that do to the provider? Did they say that'll work for us, or did they say we're closing, or I don't know. I mean, it just sounds too good to be true. That's my question.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Josephson, at this point, no providers did disenroll from end-stage renal. For many years, there was just a flat rate paid. And so as the commissioner spoke to about upper payment limits, this is one of those categories that falls into that. So we needed it to get in line. So when the Office of Rate Review set the rates, they came up with a cost-based rate based on the cost reports from the providers. So at this point, no one's disenrolled.
Follow up.
So the previous system was potentially overly generous. We were paying for services beyond their cost.
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, yes, sir. And also the vast majority of this level of service is actually paid for through the Medicare program as well.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A flat rate, would that be more in line with a fee for service, or is it a fee for service, but now you're actually just paying less fee?
Through the chair, yes, sir. It's just less fee at this point. It's not, by definition, not a value-based service yet. Another item is the pharmacy adjustments. So we have we projected this would be a $2.1 million savings, and we are on track to achieve that. This was a variety of efforts to position the Medicaid pharmacy program to react more nimbly to drug price changes. I would like to thank the legislature because under SB 74 last year, you included provisions to allow the state to update the Medicaid preferred drug and prior authorization medications list more frequently, giving us greater flexibility and negotiating power, which will help us start realizing cost savings more quickly. And so this is directly for the Medicaid program, but our Medicaid pharmacy director, Dr. Aaron Naris, is actually doing a tremendous job working across agencies as well. And so we are in a very good relationship working with Department of Corrections, which is another large utilizer of pharmaceutical, but not necessarily on the pharmacy side, about what we can do from a state perspective to increase our economy of scale and or what waivers are available to provide this level of service, but at a cheaper cost. And so it's this internal alignment issue that we're continuing to search for.
Representative Johnston.
Is there also alignment with the Department of Administration on this?
Yes, Madam Chair. Do you have to go through? Through the chair. Yes, Representative Johnston. We are also working in discussions with Division of Retirement Benefits as well as Division of Insurance, figuring out how we can do this. Some exciting prospects, I won't get too far sidetracked, is the state of Washington was actually able to receive a waiver for their pharmaceutical purchasing. And that allows some more larger purchasing and bulk power. And there's a lot of states are really looking at this, Colorado and Florida. And so there's some exciting things that we are pursuing that way. We were able to send, and it was a sponsored conference that our Medicaid pharmacy director was able to go to, and she came back with a long list of items that she is really searching down because it's good business practice, and so we're pretty excited about it.
Please continue.
For these next couple slides, they get very technical, so I will defer to Director Gayhart on these.
All right, thank you. So with limiting the physical therapy, occupational, and speech therapy, we had good intentions with the $1 million target. However, we ran into a couple of issues, one with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS. We had originally intended to put hard limits in place. Hard limits actually don't exist anymore in the eyes of CMS. Now, keeping in mind that when we're talking about limiting these, we're not looking at the under 21 age range. This is just for adults. And so we took time to really look at what are the national standards. We worked with our contractor, Comagine, who does service utilization across many states. Once we were able to get the regs in place, we are looking at a combined limit, but it's a soft limit. There are more soft caps for physical therapy and occupational therapy. There is the ability also for individuals to get service authorizations if they need something over and above that that's medically necessary. So we won't meet the target this year, but we'll carry it forward in 21. Keep going. All right, so this next one, expanding the care management program. I think those of you that are familiar with our program and have been working with us for years might refer to this as the lock-in program. We're trying to rebrand that. We're trying to be the friendlier face of Medicaid. It still has the same intent. The reality is we want to assist Medicaid recipients with being more thoughtful in their use of Medicaid services. So what this does is it ties them to one primary care provider and one pharmacy for all of their needs. We were a bit aggressive again at the beginning of last year. We thought we could bring 3,000 people on board. That's, again, a bit difficult. Regulations took longer than planned. They should be done with public comment here February 25th. We intend to, there's about 300 people in the program right now. We intend to bring about 500 more on within the next couple of months, and then by July 1st, we intend to have 1,000 people within the program. So we're a little bit under target. We're still planning on about $1 million worth of savings. And hopefully, also, we're creating some efficiencies in this as well. We had our contractor assisting us with this, Conduent, which is our fiscal agent. They were doing these services for us, but we're bringing them in-house. We believe that we'll be more efficient with the program and we'll be able to rotate more people on and through the program.
For the nurse hotline, we put forward a $500,000 savings on this. This was initially tied up in the managed care contract that we did not move forward with, and so we are finding alternative methods on this, one of them being we are actually working with Division of Retirement and Benefits to see if we can match up a similar system or tie into the system for the Alaska Care.
Caroline?
Yeah, the Alaska Care line. So this is an item that we're moving forward. This is an important aspect in today's healthcare field because getting the information at home, be able to treat things sooner is a very critical aspect, and so we look forward to getting that on board. This is an item that we will not see any savings on. This was an item that we put forward. We actually realized it would require statutory change to move this from, this initially was if you provide a Medicaid service, you had up to 12 months to then file a bill for that service. We put forward saying we change this to 6 months for that bill. That would require statutory change, and then upon further evaluation, realized this was simply a cost deferment. It would make it pay sooner, and this changed the timeline. This is an item that we will not see any savings on, and for that, we do apologize for putting forward.
Okay, so with cost of care, there's individuals in long-term care that are over the regular income standards for Medicaid. So in order for them to qualify for Medicaid, they can pay towards a portion of their cost of care. And so this effort, again, we were a little bit aggressive. We'll make about half the target. This includes work across various Medicaid components. So the Division of Public Assistance actually calculates the cost of care. Senior and Disabilities allows or lets individuals know what that cost of care is, and then Healthcare Services is actually the accounting and recovery section for the cost of care. So we'll come in a bit under target, but this will carry forward. So you'll see that savings again in 21.
The next item is the Medicare Part B premiums recovery. So this is, the department does pay for the Medicare Part B premiums for individuals who are eligible for Medicare but unable to afford the premium. It is much more affordable for the department to pay that premium difference to keep an individual on Medicare than for them to join the Medicaid program. So we are on track to recover about $1.2 million in general fund thanks to the stepped up efforts at recovery. And if as we step into the discussion about tribal reclaiming, so Director Gayhart was the one who initially set up this program for the department years ago, moving forward. So it's nice to have her in this role as the Medicaid director because of the efforts and the partnership that we have to have with our tribal health organizations. And so I'll let you go, Renee.
Okay, thank you. So we are on target for the $20 million savings this year. I did want to give you the original targets. So in 2016, when the legislature had us implement tribal reclaiming, there were targets for each of the fiscal years. So with the success of the program and all of the joint efforts of not just the tribal organizations in the state, but the non-tribal providers as well, we were able to achieve that. So after 17, state fiscal year 17 and 18, there was an additional $20 million added for savings in state fiscal year 19. Thank you to the legislature. We did offer additional positions for that. They were pretty aggressive targets. And then again, in state fiscal year 20, that's when we added another $20 million. So if you think about it in terms of 2016 to present, we added additional $40 million in reclaiming efforts because of the success in the first couple of years. Originally, we looked at really those high-dollar claims and where could we capture some of those dollars, and that was in those high-dollar categories like residential psychiatric treatment centers, long-term care, transportation. We saw we were able to achieve pretty immediate and high-dollar savings. Now, as we look at 21 and 22 moving forward, we're pretty close to the cap. You know, that $104 million is going to be pretty aggressive, but I think this isn't necessarily a category where we can just keep adding $20 million a year. So we're at that cap at this point. So I did want to give you kind of a rundown. As of the second quarter in 20, we've now saved over $210 million, and that's in general funds. So we're still moving forward, but it's a big target, and again, you know, we really appreciate the efforts of all the tribal health organizations in assisting with signing those care coordination agreements and assisting with the referral validations. One thing I did want to mention, too, is we're going through our first legislative audit since we started this process. So we've been trying to manage the risk all along, so we hope that we make it through that ledge audit. CMS follows the ledge audit, so we're pretty solid, and we believe that things are going to work out just fine with that audit. But again, I want to go back and stress the fact that I think we're at our cap, and so $104 million is where we'll probably be staying until other things may evolve. And then I guess I should just keep going.
I think that last comment was for me more than anyone.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the tribal reclaiming, is this as simple as the fact that formerly Alaska Natives who received services were having some of their services billed through Medicaid at 50 or 60%, and now we're billing them at 100% and saving general fund? Is it really that sort of the essence of it?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, actually these are prior period adjustments. So as the claims go through, they're paid at whatever percentage they would pay. So Right now, if an American Indian Alaska Native receives services at a tribal health organization, it's 100%. If they receive it at a non-tribal site, then it will pay at whatever match that individual is eligible for. We have to go back and reclaim it in prior period adjustments. So that's where the care coordination agreements between the two entities, the referral validation. So if it were at 100% in the system, that would be great, but that's not where we are based on the state health official letter. We have to go back and reclaim. So we're often looking at 2 quarters previous till now, just so we can leave room for timely filing for providers.
So another cost containment item was transportation efficiencies. So we put this forward, and then when we sat down and looked at this, because of the increased pressure we did put on the tribal reclaiming side, we did look at and understand most of the travel, the transportation costs are coming in for the tribal partners who are coming, or the tribal people who are receiving services flying on Medicaid. So, and so those dollars, this $3 million, has actually been absorbed into that $20 million increased reclaiming aspect. And so this is one of those kind of, because we've worked on this, the tribal groups put this together, this is one of those items that we are not going to see any increased savings from our efforts.
Representative Joseph Johnston?
And just for the record, because this tends to be one of those one-liners that folks pick up as far as where we can have savings, and it's it's been because of the tribal health organizations and electronic visitation verification. This isn't the issue that it sometimes tends to be anymore, that there's been adjustments to it. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Johnson, yes, that's correct. An example is in FY 2017, we did achieve $46 million when transportation was shifted to tribal entities.
I just feel that we should give some kudos to the tribal health organizations who have done a great job of actually managing this. Thank you.
Thank you. Another item upcoming that we will not have savings this year, but we will going forward, is the electronic visit verification, or the EVV program. This is for the personal care attendants who provide a lot of the home and community-based waiver services. This is a mandatory program that we have to have for the 21st Century Cures Act. And so this will be implemented and live January 1st of 2021. This is administered by the Division of Public Assistance. And for this program going forward, do thank you for appropriating the capital dollars to this in this last fiscal year. Another item that will be a little bit of delayed is the transition of services to the 1915K. This is for the Community First Choice Program, which includes CHOR. Again, this is for that SDS, that Senior Disability Services population. The projected savings represent an additional 6% in federal financial participation through this program, and it's just going through the state plan amendments and get the approvals has been a slower process than anticipated, but we are going to see that moving forward. And then the adult preventative dental. So previously the department had always put forward adult preventative dental as a program that was optional service that could be removed. This was something, while we did say we could move on without this while still providing emergency dental services, CMS started calling us and working with us that we were still on the hook to provide a minimum level of dental care. And so there was so many extra hoops to get through to actually delete the program that working through our federal qualified health centers, our other tribal health providers, and the dental clinics around the state, that it caused so much confusion and ambiguity for both the patients and the providers to have to redefine and build an entire new set of rules around the entire program. That when we looked at that, we finally ultimately decided the best thing for us to do moving forward is to fully reinstate the program. And so it was effectively eliminated starting October 1st. Any services or claims that were denied since then, starting January 1st, have actually been put forward in the billing process, and we're working to actually approve those, get those prior authorizations in, and to pay those providers.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, and I realize this is a supplemental question, but I guess I've had some concerns of how this was rolled out. And will we see a bump in the supplemental because adult dental was going away and there might have been an increase in in services needed as people were trying to get their last benefits?
Through the chair, yes.
Thank you. So, in follow-up, it cost us more money.
Through the chair, yes, it cost us because we did put forward it as a cut. Yeah. The next item is the transition of behavioral health grants. Well, this is not a Medicaid service. This was actually discussed a little bit earlier in the behavioral health aspect about this was a planned step down from SB 74 as we implement the 1115 and the administrative service organization to administer both the SUD, substance use disorder, and behavioral health services through the 1115 program. And Director Johnson gave a very good update for you. So if you didn't catch those dates when she was giving those over the phone, you've got these here about when they were approved and the other components coming online. Now, this is a slide that's put forward through our long-term forecast of Medicaid enrollment and spending in Alaska, or what we call the MESA. This is put together by Evergreen Economics and Dr. Ted Helvoid. This shows, the regression line shows you the enrollment aspect that has changed over time. Up to in FY19, we were at 247,000 unduplicated count of Medicaid-eligible people within Alaska. It's equivalent to about 35% of our population. The system has grown over time, and if you look at the blue bar, you see that the net general spend, the general fund spend out the door has remained relatively flat. Well, yes, there's a large aspect of that is because of the increased match for the expansion population. It's also due to a lot of efforts within the Division of Healthcare Services, a lot of items from the tribal health side, which is bringing in $100 million, efforts from the Medicaid, or sorry, the pharmacy rebates, and other processes like that.
Representative Johnston?
Yes, through the chair. So are we seeing a picture where we are actually serving more people for less money?
Yes, we are. If I may switch to the next slide, this one is a little bit clearer picture, and you will see from when Medicaid expansion was started in 2016, and it was still a 100% match, to then 2017, 18, and 19, when it went to 97% and on down. You see that the small amount that we do spend in state general fund dollars for the expansion population. And we do highlight that.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
And as we, have we done projections as we go forward, knowing that the formula changes going forward? Have you been working on that?
Yeah, through the chair. We're constantly looking at this. One thing that the MESA does provide is the long-term forecast, and we have bent the curve just a little bit. Last year, prior, was 4.8% projected annual growth. Now we're down to 4.6%. But when you're talking 4.6% in a $2 billion program, that adds up to be quite a bit. And so this is something that we are looking at across the board, is what do we do from our perspective to actually make sure it is best. And because of that, we actually have a lot of opportunity here in Alaska through increased sites of managed care, other global budget situations, to these regional and local-based solutions to really kind of get this under control, because we are a fee-for-service state, and to move towards a value-based service to where you're starting to pay for what we like to refer to as health and health care instead of sick care is an opportunity that we think is beneficial for Alaska.
And I think, at follow-up, I think everybody's received the MESA report, or did I just get it from... anyways, it's a very interesting report, and it's well worth the read.
Representative Josephson, and then Wool.
Thank you. Through the chair, Commissioner or Ms. Gayhart, the growth in the green bar there is the increasing percent, over 90%, or roughly, of the expansion contribution. Is that right?
It's the, through the chair, Representative Justin, it's not the percent, it's the actual dollars in the door from the feds as the expansion population grew in Alaska.
Follow up? Do we have an approximation of what that's costing us at 10%, at a 10% share from us? In other words, I know through the, I know we enrolled 50,000 Alaskans or something through the program, but what is it costing us? If I could get a fraction, I could calculate what that costs us.
Ms. Eford?
This is Santa Eford again, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Health and Social Services. We do have that calculation. We have Medicaid broken out by the expansion population, UGF federal, and the traditional Medicaid that way, and I will be happy to get that for you.
Yeah, just something that's a little bit more discreet that I can see a dollar figure relative to.
Yeah, through the chair, we have the exact numbers.
Thank you. And then, new question.
Representative Josephson.
This might be a good time to ask Ms. Gayhart about my previous question about the administration's overall position on state plan amendments, I guess, which I queried earlier about.
Commissioner Crum? Through the chair, Representative Josephson. So a lot of these items, some of these we had to put forward for state plan amendments. Some of them were regulation change. So whenever we do anything like a rate reduction or withhold inflation, CMS automatically kicks us into the Access Monitoring Review Program, which means that we have to monitor as a state, are we actually losing providers signed up to provide Medicaid services because of this rate reduction? And so it's items like that. Some of the other items like the home and community-based waiver service side, that was beyond the threshold for what the governor was comfortable with because of the loss of access for some of those senior disability groups. And so he wanted us to reinstate that they were withheld harmless. The adult dental program was an issue through working with CMS about the overall mechanics of removing the program, the entire structure, and what the minimum requirements therefore would be. And there was a lot of conversations that way. That was also going to be a state plan amendment and some of the regulatory changes. So some of this process has been slower as we move forward. Some of these other items I had put forward on the cost containment sheet do require either regulation change or state plan amendment change for the CMS services. There has been a little bit of a slowdown in some of our response from CMS on these official issues, not through our communication, because CMS is actually internally rebranded. Now it's one CMS. And they have actually changed a lot of our direct state of Alaska contacts for various programs. And they've also changed, they're moving towards a massive change for the state plan amendment, the system they use, which basically requires that we reload our entire history of an entire program manually into this new system. And so that has actually delayed the process quite a bit.
Thank you.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a lot of information on that graph, but it looks like you have it broken down into state expansion and federal expansion, state Medicaid and regular Medicaid. So the total Medicaid population would be the purple line plus the red line, which you don't have totaled up for the total number of people under the Medicaid system. Is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Wall, the entire graph bar is actually the population side. So wait, I apologize, your question. Sorry, if you want the population enrollment, I have to go back a slide. For your question, I apologize.
Follow up then. So back to the other graph. So the total bars is population and dollars embedded in the same graph. So They're tracking proportionally exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess the other takeaway is it looks like if you look at the state Medicaid spending plus the expansion spending, the increase there is many, many times less than the increase in the total federal spending, which you can conclude is a lot of money coming into our economy for minimal investment, and hence medical services, one of the few growth industries in our state right now.
Through the chair, yes, sir.
Please continue. Representative Johnston.
Since this is the last Medicaid slide, I just again want to ask the question concerning the supplemental. Do we know when we run out of Medicaid funds and, you know, so we know what to do with the supplemental?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, yes. Santa Eford will put that together and try to get that as soon as possible. on when we our projected dates are.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I do appreciate your patience as that's a lot of information across specific programs. I will be able to condense this down a little bit, but just, you know, as we're going to move forward, we are taking a long-term view because the mission of the department, and it is in statute, it's Article 7 of the Constitution, is to promote and protect the health and well-being of Alaskans. And this is what we take very seriously. This is something coming into this role. We work with all of the directors to make sure they understand because each individual division has its own mission of what they are trying to serve, and it defines the population they're trying to serve. And so we really focus on that. So some of the things that we're really looking at are systems alignment and change. And so when we named Deputy Commissioner Albert Wall as the Medicaid director side, we also brought over behavioral health. And so if you look at in one of your handouts, there actually is an org chart. And it's the one that has my name at the top as commissioner. That actually shows you the current org chart that we're working with. But you can see for all the Medicaid side, behavioral health, healthcare services, public assistance, and senior disability services are now fully lined up. And then Deputy Commissioner Clinton Lasley has Pioneer Homes, API, Children's Services, and Juvenile Justice. So one of the things we're doing for the system alignment is actually working to get Medicaid back under one roof. By doing that, in this large system, they all have to work together because they all serve cross-population. And so we need to make sure that we are doing the best thing that we can when it comes to regulatory change, information, and updates that we're getting from the federal government, that we're making sure we're responding as much as possible. And so there's a lot of aspects there that we're trying to do. Other items for change are working towards what we like to call is the climbing the economic ladder to address benefits cliff. And so this is something that the federal government has taken on as well. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is taking the lead on a cross-agency council. And so some of their subsidiaries or sister agencies like Administration of Children and Families have had a couple of conferences that we've attended where we're actually talking about what can we do to help families use this. And they're encouraging us to work towards braided funding, which is multiple programs like using TANF dollars, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, and SNAP, the Nutritional Assistance Program. How do we use those? Because under the food stamp or the SNAP program, there's actually dollars for E&T or employment and training. And so how do we work these programs together to maximize this for Alaskans? And these are a lot of the ideas that we're going towards. Most of our conversations with our federal partners is what is the flexibility that we can have to actually look towards getting individuals to actually progress forward so they're not eligible for these systems for these programs anymore without the need for them. Because far too often what ends up happening is if somebody has a little bump in economic prosperity, they then lose a disproportionate amount of benefits. And so it's a rational economic thought to then not want to grow economically. And so we want to address this. And the nice thing is with our federal partners, we are trying to address that. They've given us some short-term solutions to look at, which we are going to examine. Other aspects are the focus on the IT system. So we've got the eligibility verification systems for the personal care attendants. And the other thing is the eligibility verification system for the Medicaid program and public assistance. A lot of our federal programs require certain asset tests or other eligibility programs for these different programs, and we're going to have the system go live January 1st of 21. And so the goal of that is to really make sure it's the program integrity. And by program integrity, that is the individuals who really truly need these services get the focused attention and resources of these services. And it's items like that, whereas the EVV is actually protecting against the provider aspect to make sure providers aren't fraud and cheating the system. And so it's working in conjunction on that to make sure that who needs a service gets the service. The other thing is we've got electronic document management system at public assistance. Essentially, that is a scanner. It's a functional scanner. Because of all the protected health information throughout, a lot of the information that DPA or public assistance uses is actually on paper record. And when they want to go in and find information, they have to dig through banker's boxes. And so this is something that was identified my first week on the job, and I brought that forward. We've gotten the system live. But one of the unique aspects is this will be the first step in allowing us to work towards a single entry portal, so no wrong door, meaning one application and then what other services you're eligible for, we can kick that out faster. Because one thing we were very mindful of is individuals reaching out to public assistance, they need an answer now, whether that's yes or no, so they know what community resources to go to. The other aspect is emergency readiness and response, which is a main thing of the public Division of Public Health. When you look at what has occurred over the last year in the large earthquake in 2018, where the road and the transportation system were knocked down, this is the group that actually started up the Emergency Operations Center, and we have reached out to every single licensed assisted living home, medical facility, to make sure that the individuals had the proper resources. If they did not, we would find a way to get it to them. Most recently, you've heard about the novel coronavirus. And so there was a national health emergency just declared on this by the president, and so it enacted certain travel restrictions and screening protocols, encouraging all states to spin up their public health and epidemiology teams to help coordinate information. So this is led by Dr. Ann Zink. So she's here in the room with us as well. And so she's been taking lead of this for the state and working with the Centers for Disease Control, the Administration of Children and Families for Repatriation. Last week, we actually had to have a flight, passenger flight of American citizens chartered from Wuhan, China, land in Anchorage, go through the Customs and Border Protection process, go through the CDC screening, and then get back on the plane and then leave. And so it was a successful process, and we're tracking that across the board. Right now, there are no cases in Alaska, but we are fully prepared and on the preventative side. It's the education aspect. How do we react to this? How do we take care of this issue and prevent this spread in Alaska? And so it's the modernization of that system, because we have to actively work on how we're going to address this. Last summer, for example, a new issue was the measles case. We had one measles case, and we know how contagious that is, but because of the spin-up of the public health team, that was kept to one measles case. And so that is the goal, is to operate behind the scenes and the boots on the ground to take care of that. And then the last thing moving forward is our behavioral health continuum of care. Currently, this is API or nothing. And then over the last year, we've actually addressed this as a group and as a state, and we've had massive community investment. Hospitals have invested for in-community care. Fairmix Memorial Hospital put up designated evaluation and treatment beds. Matsu Regional just recently opened them up. Providence is a huge partner when it comes to behavioral health treatment, and so is Bartlett Hospital here in Juneau. And so we have these holes that we're trying to fill throughout the system, because we have to get over the stigma of behavioral health and the importance of it. With the 1115 moving forward, the goal is to provide more appropriate levels of care sooner and in community, and which is why Medicaid state plan services will be different than the 1115 services. It's 23 new services that can be billed against. Part of this is the crisis stabilization plan, which a number of representatives have actually traveled down to Arizona to see the Crisis Now model, along with public safety, corrections, and people from the Mental Health Trust. This is some holes in the system that we are very excited to fill moving forward, because as we address these issues, it allows for increased family resiliency, meaning individuals whose substance abuse treatment or mental health problems can get identified sooner, get the treatment they need to maintain employment, to maintain their families, and stay in community. And that is the goal of what we want. So I apologize, I had to condense that down very quick. Thank you very much to the committee. And if there's any specific questions because of this information, please reach out. We will be happy to share that either committee-wide or to your individual offices on specific questions.
Do you have any questions? I see no questions. So with that, thank you very much for your presentation. Our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, February 4th at 1:30 p.m. And at that meeting, we'll hear the department budget overviews from the Department of Education, as well as the Department of Administration. So with that, we will be adjourned at 3:32 p.m. Thank you.